says it's the end of time. And the Mississippi River, she's a gold grind. The interest is up and the stock market down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. My woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Hey, 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 this is Bubba Da Vinci, and you're listening to Self-Reliance Exposed, brought to you by Backwoods Home Magazine. And with me always is my co-host and friend, Colorado Ron. How you doing, Colorado?
Good, man, good. How you been, bud?
All right, Merry Christmas.
Yeah, Merry Christmas to you, of course. Well,
yeah, I was going to say, by the time people are listening, it'll be post-Christmas.
Yep.
People will be getting geared up for New Year's.
This is dedication, though. We're doing this on Christmas Eve.
That's right. We're coming to you on Christmas Eve. We're doing our pre-recording. Well, of course, you know, it's self-serving interest because we want to make sure that we don't have anything to do from Christmas the last couple of days. But
of course.
Yeah, hopefully we have lots of things to play with. I don't know, you know, I haven't seen anything under the tree as of yet for me, but I know it's coming. So are you all prepared for Christmas?
Actually, I am. For the first time, we got everything done, and we're good to go, ready to go. So,
now, how's the weather been out there?
You know, it's just been fine. Today is the coldest it's ever been, but it's still not snowy weather, but I hear snow's coming. So we may have a white Christmas after all.
And we've got our white Christmas. We had a blizzard come through and hit us pretty hard this last week. And then I got up this morning thinking, you know, being told, I mean, we've had temperatures in the low teens. Tonight's negative one. And that's the way it's supposed to be, like the single digits to the negative digits for the next 5 days. But we actually woke up to snow flurries this morning.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, it's. I mean, it's good to have the white Christmas going on, but, you know, it also means, you know, shoveling snow and icy roads and trying to get out to the family. So as much as I love it, and on top of that, you know, killed the hunting and the trapping.
So, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, give or take. So, today we'll be talking to two different groups. We have Jeff Yeago, who writes for Backwoods Home Magazine and is an expert in the field of solar everything.
Solar
everything. And he has an article that will be coming up, I believe, the next two or three issues. I mean, it's in the next issue, but I think it's a two or a three-parter. And it's going to be talking about, rechargeable batteries and, you know, setting yourself up for renewable energy via having solar. So I think that's perfect post-Christmas.
Yeah.
Everybody will be burning through batteries like they're going out of style. And then our vendor for the week is Texas Ready. And it seems like winter's already, you know, only been here a short time, but, you know, 4 months down the road, we're going to be looking at spring already.
I know.
And Texas Ready is that does the heritage seeds, and so it's probably a good time for you to look into what you're going to be planting next year and start your strategizing.
Yes, I'm excited. I'm ready. I'm geared up for this this next spring. Or how are you? Are you ready?
No, I'm not even ready for Christmas, and it's here.
Yeah, we got all our planter boxes done and all the new soil in them, ready to go. So.
Yeah, see, because you guys got a lot further. I mean, you guys did a great job last year. You did your raised beds and really spent a lot of time getting everything prepped last year. And you had a pretty good harvest too, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had a ton. So we're pretty excited. We're hoping to do a lot more this year.
Yeah. So I mean, this is going to be my year to get on it. Last year we did a lot of prepping of the ground and everything else, and we just didn't get our, you know, the stuff that I had screwed up on and was already in the ground did well by rhubarb and things like that. But we got so busy last year with throwing up five shows and doing everything else.
Oh,
I just never really got to put anything in the ground. And So my ground should be great for this coming year. I just have to make sure I'm getting it all seeded up so I can reap the benefits.
There you go.
So I want to kind of get your opinion on something. You know, it's unfortunately, since the last time we talked, we've had that unfortunate shooting in Connecticut.
Yes.
And the young man who was mentally disturbed shot up and killed a bunch of young children, which is horrible. And this has created a huge, not only media, but government push on high-capacity weapons.
Yeah.
And, I mean, for the first time in history, Walmart is completely sold out of ammo. I mean, they made an announcement last week that they were sold out of everything.
Yeah.
I've been to 3 gun shows over the past week to try to, you know, to see what's going on and things like that. And not only are they wall-to-wall people, but there's like 6-hour waiting list to get your background check done. And
that's at a gun show.
Yeah, 6 hours at a gun show. And people are just buying everything off the shelf. I mean, I was there on a Friday night. They opened at 5 p.m. on a Friday. And I walked into the gun show at 5 p.m. There were already, you know, several hundred people inside, and they were just saying, I'll take that, I'll take that. They weren't asking, I mean, the prices didn't seem to matter. Nothing seemed to matter. All they wanted was the guns.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what's your take on this? I mean,
I think it's a bunch of hype.
You do?
Yeah.
And why do you think it's a bunch of hype?
Because, well, I just think that everybody's in a scare factor, just because something gets mentioned. Listen, every Democratic president has said that they're going to ban high capacity weapons, and even if the ban goes on, it comes off or whatever. I mean, we got this pre-ban stuff from like before Clinton, and that hasn't affected anything. You know, I see these. All it does is super hyperinflate the guns. You know, I go to a website, and I've seen AK-47s, for instance, go from $450 to over $1,000. But you know, there's no end to the supply of those AK-47s that keep popping up. I think that it does happen, and I think that you need to have your weapons. But here's one of the interesting parts, though, that I found very interesting is ammo choices, right? Now, everybody says you should have a 9mm because 9mm is one of the most common rounds out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Walmart. Guess which ammo was missing? 9mm. 9mm was gone, but they had an entire section of 357 mag sitting there. So what I did is I went down and I went through their inventory of what was left because it was picked pretty clean, and I found it very interesting. 22 long rifle was completely gone, but they had 22 mag. Again, 9mm was gone, 45 ACP was gone, 223 was gone, and set was 7.62 was all gone. Everything was gone. But what was there was 357 mag, 44 mag, they had a ton of. They had 30-06, 270. I would highly recommend that people go, if you're near Walmart, go down to Walmart right now and take a look at what's missing and what's there. Now, this is just a little sample of what's going to happen, and there's going to be a run on ammo if an emergency happens. And you want to know what's going to be available and what's not going to be available. And for all those that say, oh, get a 9mm because everybody's going to have one, well, guess what? Yeah, everybody's going to have one, and the 9mm is gone. And so
that doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, because I get what you're saying, but the logic of getting a 9mm is because if something were to happen and you had to get ammo from your neighbor, that means that they're more than likely what they've stockpiled is 9mm, not 30.
Well, exactly. But what I'm saying is don't only have the 9mm. Look at see what the store still has plenty of in stock, and maybe grab one of those as a spare or a backup.
Yeah, but you also realize the reason why those rounds are still there, because I have a 357, I have a 44 Magnum, and a Win Mag 270 and 243, and the problem is the reason why no one wants those is it costs you $1.50 a round. It's the reason why those are out there is they're the most expensive rounds you can buy per shot.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got that ranch hand, and it cost me $70 to get 100 rounds. Yeah, it's. I mean, you can get cheaper stuff. I mean, I went and bought 100 rounds of the Target loads, and it was still $53.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but what I'm saying, though, is in a time where you need ammo, if there's no other ammo out there, you're not going to care if it's a buck around. And the fact that they even have it when everything else is gone. Listen, all the guns were gone. All the guns were sold. The only 12-gauge they had there was 7.5 shot. So basically bird shot. I mean, that's the only 12-gauge round they had there. 22 long rifle was completely gone. Every gun in the store was gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, what this tells me is, I'm not completely disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that, I still live by my rule of four, which is, and stock up deep when you're there. My point, my whole thing is there's a lot of people out there that have not heeded the warnings in the past, and they're reactive as opposed to proactive, which is what we keep trying to teach is be proactive, don't be reactive.
Right.
And I mean, if you're going to wait until they're going to take your ammo away, then, and you have to run down there at the last second to go buy it, yeah, you're going to be left with exactly whatever's left.
Yep.
And if that's the case, if that's the case, guess what, guys? You're going to end up buying a 44 Magnum weapon, and you're going to be buying a buck a shot. But if Colorado Ron is right, and this thing calms down, don't put yourself in a position where this ends up happening again. Go down and take $100 or $200 or whatever you can afford each month until you feel like you have enough of whatever calibers you have and stockpile it. Don't wait for the run on the market.
Do you think this is a knee-jerk reaction, or do you think this is bad?
You know me.
Yeah.
And I've never been a conspiracy theorist sort of person. And what I have noticed in the past week is the left and the left media really taking advantage of this. And they've been trying to get better and better gun control for years now. And when Columbine happened and these other shootings happened, you were shooting adults and you were shooting teenagers. And I've always said, a big thing about terrorism is children. Children are the perfect terrorist tool because in the United States, our hearts bleed every time a child falls down a well or skins its knee.
Yeah.
And so someone taking out a bunch of kindergartners was a major catalyst, probably the biggest catalyst we've ever had in this country to really have a conversation about what the next step is in arms control. Then on top of that, we've had every little shooting that would have never made the news before is popping up every day.
I saw that. I saw Argentina had two shootings or something, and it made the news. I'm like, why is that even on the?
Yeah, there was one. There was one.
It happens all the time. Why is Argentina's two shootings in a mall popping up on Drudge?
There was one.
But everything. You're right. Every shooting is popping up on Drudge.
Yeah, I mean, there was one in a bar. Three people shot at a bar. Today, apparently, there was a fire. My wife was telling me there was a fire, and a fireman was shot because someone started shooting at him when they were trying to get to the to put out the fire. I mean, right now, it's the perfect time for the media to jump on this bandwagon, and every time something happens with the gun, to bring it to the front and say, look how bad it is. And so for the first time, I'm actually concerned. I've never been concerned in the past. I don't, and I don't like the language. Obama's already proven himself, and so we're not just talk politics here, but our president has already pointed out that he's great at using executive orders, and ramrodding things through, and he's using very broad language, like as opposed to saying banning assault weapons or things like that, banning high capacity weapons. So anything over a revolver could theoretically be a high capacity weapon. And they're
right.
they're not saying semi-automatics. They're just saying high capacity rounds, high capacity weapons.
Yeah.
So they're giving themselves, you know, they've always targeted something specific, assault weapons, you know, this type of weapon, that type of weapon. And then, you know, so they're targeting something specific. This time they've painted such a broad, you know, they have such a broad stroke by just saying high capacity weapons that who knows where it's going to go. And I think that's what's got everybody freaked out,
mm-hmm.
is, you know, if you got this many people on, you know, jumping all over this and they use such a broad stroke, something's going to get passed and you don't know what.
Yeah, I can see that. I do see that. And I guess my take is on it as well as, like you mentioned, you know, is, you know, try to be proactive. I've got everything that I planned on getting. I've already got it. So I guess I don't look at it. I haven't gone to the gun shows, and I haven't seen what everybody's, you know, running on and freaking out about. But I have noticed that the increased activity online as far as gun sales on the website that I go and check out, which is armslist.com.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just a, it seems like every day people are posting, but it's ridiculous. Like, you know, like I said, the, you know, $1,000 AKs now and $2,000 AR-15s. It's just like, whatever.
Yeah, I
don't even
you.
Look at them and click on them anymore. But,
you're
right.
I agree with you on that portion. The gun market has definitely used it to their advantage to jack up the prices because, you know, most of the ARs were going for probably anywhere from $500 to $900, depending on what model you get. Now you can't touch one under 12, and they go up to $3,000.
Yeah.
And, Glocks and most of the pistols have gone up about $200.
Did you hear about Cheaper Than Dirt, though? That's the big news.
No, what's that?
Cheaper Than Dirt put out an announcement that until further notice, they're no longer selling firearms. And they had a huge, huge backlash among the firearm enthusiasts in the community, and they lost, I can't remember, I think last count was like $16,000 likes on their website, and it's just been dropping like crazy, and people have just said that they're not buying from Cheaper Than Dirt anymore.
Wow. There's a major backlash. You're right. I think everybody's panicking. I don't think this legislation is going to get pushed through quickly if there is any legislation that gets out there. Although, you know, with the fiscal cliff looming over there, I also think this, you know, if I were a conspiracy theorist, I would say that, you know, someone in government decided that they got a double whammy here. If you could have something like this happen and you could use this to overshadow that we're a week and a half away from going over the fiscal cliff, and, you know, but just keep throwing out there that, oh, look at all these shootings, look at all these shootings. And number two, that you could use it to get some sort of gun control. It's like having your cake and eating it too.
I see that. I see that, no, without a doubt.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, I just wanted to get your opinion on that. Like, I've got everything I want from my gun selection too. Yeah, but when this happened, I kind of wanted to see. I had gone into a sporting goods store. We have a sporting goods store here called Shields.
You have a sporting goods store there?
Not in our little town, but in the
I'm just kidding.
Way far away.
I got to rub it in, everyone.
Yeah, that's okay. And I walked inside there because I was looking for a gift for my wife and for a Christmas gift. And I walked through the gun section, as I always do, just looking and seeing what's new out. And they had a 4-hour waiting list. I mean, there were like 40 people in line buying weapons, and they had a sign hanging over their federal background check department that says could take up to 4 hours. The FBI's computers are overloaded. And I was just like, you got to be kidding me. So then there was two gun shows that were coming up, and I talked to my family members, hey, let's go check this out. I just want to see what it's like. And when we pulled in, it was like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Yeah, it's pretty nuts out there, and I will say this though, if you have an AK-47 and an AR-15 and you haven't bought all the ammo you need, you're in trouble.
Yeah,
because a lot of that's going.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are going to come back, and we need to talk with Jeff Yeago. Let's go ahead and we'll jump to commercial break, and when we come back, we'll give him a call. How's that sound, Colorado?
Sounds good, man. Let's do it.
All right.
If everything you eat comes out of boxes stored in your freezer, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo. If you're afraid to take out your own garbage because the neighbor kids might beat you up, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
Over 50 training classes are coming to the Self-Reliance Expo. This family-friendly event focuses on traditional values and long-forgotten skills. Gardening, alternative home building, off-grid living, food preservation, cooking with the sun, self-defense classes, canine demos, and more.
If you can kill a houseplant just by looking at it, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
The Self-Reliance Expo is fun for the whole family and is the largest of its kind in the nation. Learn how to do it yourself. Learn how to defend yourself. Save money. Save a life.
If the only screwdriver you own is made of orange juice and vodka, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
It's the Self-Reliance Expo, coming soon. Find out more by going to SelfRelianceExpo.com. That's SelfRelianceExpo.com.
All right. Welcome back to Self-Reliance Exposed with Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci. You ready to give Jeff Yeago a call, Colorado?
Yeah, yeah. I'm excited. Let's do it.
All right. Here we go. I'm getting better at this, so we're going to add, and then we're going to look for Jeff. And I think the good news is I already plugged these names in this week. Normally what I'm doing is I'm going through and trying to find everybody, and then I even have Texas Ready keyed in. All right, let's give this gentleman a call.
Jeff Yeago.
Hey, Jeff Yeago. It's Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci.
Hello.
Hey, Jeff?
Yes, sir.
How's it going?
I cannot complain.
Hey, this is Bubba Da Vinci and Colorado Ron. I think Bubba's mic's going out or something, but I hear him coming and going. But how you doing?
Good. We've had pretty decent weather here up until today, and we've got a little bit of spitting of snow, but it's been actually in the probably mid-50s up until yesterday, so we're finally starting to turn cold.
Yeah, yeah, same here. You know, it's been really nice, and I've been enjoying the nice warm weather, and then all of a sudden it's starting to turn cold, which I guess is good. I guess we all want a little white Christmas. You think you're going to get a white Christmas?
You know, I didn't think we were, but we might get a white New Year's, so the way it looks right now.
Nice, nice. Where are you? What state are you in again?
I'm in Virginia, and I'm physically in a pretty rural part of Virginia. I'm in an area called Haydensville, Gum Spring area, which is just a wide spot in the road. We're about halfway between Richmond and Charlottesville. Charlottesville, of course, is the University of Virginia's school town, and in between is just mountains and trees, so not much around me, but typically just the woods.
Huh, okay. Well, what we wanted to do is we wanted to cover your article that's coming out about recharging batteries.
Sure, we can talk about that if you like.
Yeah, I would love to get some input on that. You know, obviously it's Christmas time, and everybody's going to be burning through batteries like crazy. So I thought it was a good topic. We thought that that would be a perfect topic to cover. So what do you think?
I think so too, and I had similar thoughts. What kicked us off, if you want to get started, is about 2 years ago, somewhere in that range. I kind of got to noticing all the batteries I was discarding, and I felt like I was typical of anybody else, but in I'm not so much worried about the landfill, it's just the whole process, and decided I would do a test. So I got one of those big plastic pretzel jars that was empty, and I just put it by the door of our, you know, small office here, and wrote a little tag on there that said discard old batteries. And about 2 years later, not only is this jar full, but I can barely lift it. It's it probably weighs, I would say, at least 30 or 40 pounds. There's nothing in it but flashlight batteries and the little square 9-volt batteries and, you know, C cells and D cells and a lot of little AAAs and AAs you find in cameras and things of that nature. So anyway, when I saw how much this really was, I'm thinking, while I may go through more batteries than maybe an average person, that's still a lot of batteries. And so I started checking into this and doing some research, and I found out that two things. One, yes, we discard a tremendous amount of batteries, and some of these contain some very exotic materials that are probably not suitable for us to be leaching into our groundwater and things of that nature. And the other thing I found out was, you know, up until now, my memory of rechargeable batteries wasn't that good. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, the rechargeable batteries typically were the NiCads. These guys had two problems. One, they didn't hold their charge very long, and two, they had the memory problem, and that was that if you tried to recharge one when it was only, say, half discharged, the next time you used it, it would only give you the top half of the charge. It would no longer drop below whatever level it was charged to the last time.
Yeah, I've heard about that, yeah.
So they call it the memory effect. Well, I mean, both of these reasons have kind of kept me away from rechargeable batteries. And as I started looking online and checking out and doing some research, and I found out that although the NiCads have improved the memory effect some, there's some newer versions of NiCad technology, probably what, you know, most of us are familiar with nowadays is the nickel metal hydride batteries.
Uh-huh.
That is typically what you're going to find in a store if you are looking for a rechargeable battery. And I think that's probably driven by the electronic cameras. I know I had a small electronic camera that would just eat batteries. I mean, it would just go through, you know, a couple of packs a day of these things. And so people started using these nickel metal hydride batteries probably for the camera. I know it's very easy to find AA and AAA in that particular type of battery, but it's harder to find some of the other sizes still. But anyway, these batteries, they can be recharged over 1,000 times, and some brands, not all of them, but some brands will keep their charge over a year. Some of them will hold up to 75% of their charge for 2 years, which is a pretty long, you know, self-discharge period. So, anyway, these are some newer versions of the nickel metal hydride.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
They're basically called NIM. When you look at the abbreviation, when you look on the packet, it'll say NIH or NIMH. NIM.
Correct. And some of them will have a added to that designation. LSD, which is not the drug, but it means low self-discharge, long self-discharge. So they may have that designation on, too, as LSD as part of the word, and that just means that they will keep their charge much longer now. But anyway, this these two things kind of came together in a perfect storm, and so I decided I'm going to see what it would take for me to convert over to rechargeable batteries and see what lessons I learned that might be of interest to other people. And so I started down this path, and I found, I think, three things that were stumbling blocks that I wanted to help people overcome. One is it's still not easy to find some sizes of the newer technology rechargeable batteries. For example, as I said, the AA's, which are used in cameras, are fairly easy to find. I think I've even seen those at Lowe's and Home Depot and places like that. But to find a rechargeable 9-volt battery, for example, is not easy. You may be able to find some D-size, the large flashlight batteries now. They're a little easier to find, but not the C-cell, which is a little smaller than the D. So anyway, for somebody who wants to get into this seriously, they're probably still going to have to go online and order some sizes online. But the article I put together, I have listed all the major brands of rechargeable batteries and their ratings. And I found that in each size of battery, there's a big difference in the advertised storage capacity from one manufacturer to the other, and I'm assuming that's probably also reflected in the price. So folks kind of need to, when they see a really good buy on a particular battery, rechargeable battery, they might want to refer to this table I'm going to have out soon that will let them compare from one brand to the next, that possibly the lower price one may have less than, you know, maybe half the capacity of the others. So that was something I learned. The second thing I learned was that if you want to avoid having 15 different battery chargers, you know, because you can buy a battery charger for AA batteries, you can buy a battery charger for D size batteries, and you don't, and then add to that you have rechargers for your cell phones and iPads and laptops, and so all of a sudden we are, as you pointed out when we started, all the games and toys coming out for Christmas, we all suddenly have a house full of battery chargers, all designed for one specific type of toy or game or electronic appliance, and we want to kind of avoid that too. So again, further research and discuss in the article, but there's now some really great chargers out there that are smart. They have computer technology built into them. They're not expensive. Probably we're talking in the $30 to $75 price range. But these chargers, they will accept any size battery you put in them, from the really tiny AAA up to the large D cells and even the 9-volt rectangular batteries. But one battery charger you can buy will recharge any of these battery sizes. And what's really cool is they recognize the type of battery you put in them and can recharge different batteries and sizes and different types at the same time. So, for example, if you plug in an iCAD battery, which has the memory effect, the charger will say, oh, okay, I see what you are. I will discharge you fully first, and then I'll start recharging you. And in the slot next to it, you might have a different size nickel metal hydride battery or something of that nature, and the charger will recognize that technology and adjust its charging rate for that. So there's some really cool chargers out now that means we can get rid of a large number of those chargers that we have scattered all over the house. And so finally, what I found out is if you're going to do this really seriously, you need to try to centralize everything at one location, and you need to have extra rechargeable batteries that have been charged. So the biggest pain is you go out and buy rechargeable batteries for, say, a camera, and then you use the camera and the batteries run down, and so now you've got to go plug the batteries in a charger and wait 4 hours to use your camera again. Well, that's not good either. So I'm pointing out to folks that they need to kind of take an inventory of what they have in their home that uses rechargeable batteries, what sizes of batteries they would be using. And, for example, if you have, let's say, two flashlights that use C-cell batteries, and each one uses two batteries, well, right there is four batteries, so we probably want to have at least a six or eight of that battery size total, two in each flashlight, and then maybe two that have just been charged up. So when you go to replace a rechargeable battery, you're going to replace it with a rechargeable battery that's fully recharged, and that eliminates the final problem of using rechargeable batteries, which is you do have to have more batteries than what's just in your device. And
right.
since they now will hold their charge for over a year, when you go to reach for that rechargeable battery, when you finally need to switch out, you don't have to worry about it also being dead. So anyway, nutshell, that's how I got here.
Okay. Well, what's the life expectancy of some of those batteries? Because one person had a great idea, and I can't remember where I heard this, but somebody told me to go down to Home Depot and get those lights that you put out in the yard with the solar powered lights,
rip
out the cheap AA's out of those and put the nice ones in there, and then that way you always have them charging. If you ever need them in a pinch, you can just go out there and pull them out of one of those yard lights. But what is the life expectancy with the charge and discharge and charge and discharge? What is the life expectancy?
Well, I know that the batteries that you're referring to, we're in an area where we just went through a power outage that lasted several weeks in this last storm, and a lot of people who weren't that prepared went out and bought a bunch of the yard lights that Walmart usually has them pretty cheap, and they bought a bunch of the solar-powered yard lights, and they'd leave them outside all day long to charge up, and then they would bring them in at night to light up different rooms of their house. So, that's kind of a takeoff of what you're asking about. But the batteries in those probably are not your best rechargeable batteries. These things are made fairly inexpensively. And, you can buy one for $7 or $8 for the whole fixture. But remember also, a yard light is being charged and discharged 365 times a year. And I said earlier that, the best rechargeable batteries have a cycle rate of maybe 1,000 cycles. So even an inexpensive rechargeable battery in a solar yard light would probably reach the end of its life in less than 3 years, even under ideal situations. And the ones I've had have not lasted much longer than a year. So,
but you can't replace those batteries with the quality lights or with the quality.
Yes, you can. Most of them use a little AA size battery, and you certainly can replace them with a better quality rechargeable battery. Right now, in all my comparisons, as far as an off-the-shelf, readily available battery, the Sanyo is making what appears to be the longest life rechargeable battery compared to the other brands I looked at. Now, that's not true in all sizes, but in majority of sizes, Sanyo makes a battery called a InLoop, E-N-E-L-O-O-P, which is, when I compared it with the other batteries, it probably had, I'd say 25% more milliamp hour capacity than the others of the same size and brands, and different brands. So you do need to kind of look at the ratings, which usually it's stamped on the side of the battery, but in my world of solar, where we typically are dealing with large batteries, batteries that could weigh up to a ton per battery, I'm normally dealing in amp hours. So when we're talking about these small little AA, AAA CNB cell batteries, when you have a rating of milliamp hours, it's kind of hard to get your head around that. But it's the same thing. It's just, you just have to realize it's like just a smaller version of amp hours is the milliamp hours. And it's still treated the same way. It's basically, time and amps. So that's, an easy way to think of it.
Well, let me ask you this. So you're talking about these new charging stations. And, where do you find these charging stations and what are they running now for something, let's say, that'll do – I mean, how big are they? Can you get one that'll hold 30 batteries?
I guess the smart answer would be wait for my article to come out because I actually show you how to build one. But the charging stations I talked about, they are I bought 1, 2, 3. I have 4 different brands I've purchased just to kind of compare them together, and they all are very similar in size. And to answer your question, the size would be about the size of a let me think of something that would be – I'm thinking of a small book. I'm looking at several of them right now, which they're about the width of my hand spread out and probably about 2 to 2.5 inches thick in height. Rectangular in shape. So that would be, maybe about 6 to 7 inches wide, about 4 to 5 inches deep, and maybe 2 inches tall. Now, I discussed the different brands. They all do a good job. They all will accept multiple sizes of batteries, and the least size that I would recommend is one that has 4 slots. In other words, you could recharge 4 batteries at one time. But they do make them that will recharge 8 batteries, 16 batteries. I saw some that will recharge like 30 batteries at a time. I guess that would be more commercial, say maybe a company that had a lot of walkie-talkies that they used every day, something along those lines. But typically I would say a unit that had at least 4 slots in it and as many as 8 would be more than adequate for a typical home. And what I did was my goal was to build something that anybody could build with, minimal tools, minimal skills, and would end up with looking fairly nice. And
well, that's good because Colorado and I have minimum of both.
Well, what I did was I wanted to centralize everything. So I designed this battery charging station, and I found one of these plastic parts cases, the type that you can see through, and you open it up and it has dividers that you can put bolts and things in. And I found one of those for $4 at a like I said, at one of the builder supply houses, they're available anywhere. And I took one of those, just took the lid off of it, and made that as a drawer. It had the dividers, it was see-through, and it was a drawer. And then I built out of wood, just plywood and some scrap pieces of small pieces of wood, I built what I call my charging station. So it has this plastic drawer in the bottom of it where you put all the batteries of different sizes after they've been charged up. And then right above that boxed-in drawer is the shelf area that the portable charger or chargers fit on, just sit there. And then it has a little back wall on it, and I built in one of those multi-outlet strips, extension outlets, so you have this one extension line, one cord coming off of this thing, but there on the back of it, you have places you can plug in multiple chargers. So now you have a place where you can charge your cell phones, your iPad, and all your rechargeable batteries. So you now have one place in the house that you can locate and know that's where everything is that's being recharged. It has a switch on it, on the outlet, so when you're not charging anything, you can turn that switch off, and all your chargers are now, they've stopped drawing any power, which is always a problem with a lot of these wall wart chargers, where as long as they're plugged in, they're using electricity, even if they're not charging anything. So anyway, the article goes on to describe how to build one of these, and using, I think I spent a total of $30 in materials, and I painted it. It looks good. I mean, it looks, I'm not a woodworker, I'm not a cabinet maker, but the way I built it was I tried to find something where all you needed was a saw and a screwdriver and some paint and glue. And like I said, all of the lumber was bought locally, nothing special. So I think the idea is to, if you're going to do this, you have to make it convenient to find the batteries when you need them, and you have to have batteries that you know are charged. And so that was the advantage of having this little drawer. Whenever I take batteries out of a device that are now discharged, I go over to the charging station, I put them in the charger sitting on the top of it, pull the drawer out and select whichever size battery I need to put back into the device, knowing that not only are those recharged batteries, but they probably are maintaining their charge, even if they've been there a couple of months. So anyway, that's what, kind of in a nutshell, what I discovered and the way I solved the problem.
So what's the approximate total cost for doing this, like a project like this, and how much time, if I were to do it, well, let's not use me because I'm a terrible example. It takes me four times longer. So if Colorado Ron were to go into his garage and do this, how long should it take him to build something like this if he has all the components in front of him?
I built it in about 3 hours. I would say, I have a garage area. I do have a well-equipped workshop, although I tried to avoid using any of the special equipment. I mean, I have pneumatic nailers and things of that nature, but it took me about 3 hours to put together, and then I spray painted it, and then overnight, it dried and was ready to use the next day. I would think that certainly somebody could build this in a weekend without any trouble. A couple hours each day should be enough. My directions are pretty clear on the sizes to cut the pieces of lumber, and what they even tell you what sizes to buy. For example, if you need three pieces of 1x1 that's 8 inches long, I point out that you just need to buy one 24-inch long, piece of wood. I don't have to go out and buy three short pieces. So I've tried to make it easy to understand the materials. And as far as cost, not counting the recharger, but counting the strip outlet, the plastic drawer, and the lumber, I spent $30. You're going to add to that anywhere from $35 to $75 for the multi-battery charger. The better ones have display meters on them that let you see how each battery is, what its charge level is at the time. The less expensive ones just have a little LED that lights up when the battery is fully recharged. But either way, they all seem to do a good job of recharging the batteries. It's just some have a few more bells and whistles than the other ones did.
Okay, so we're talking, we'll call it $60 to $70, for that. Now, does that include, that's just to recharge via AC. Is there a way to get it, how much would it cost to also convert this so it could do solar?
Well, that's another thing I point out is some of these rechargers that I'm talking about the ones that you buy that can have, you know, 4 or 8 batteries. Some of them are designed around what you would call a universal power supply. In other words, you know, you could plug them in Europe. If you're dealing with, say, 240 volt electricity in 50 cycle, or U.S. at 120 at 60 cycle, some of them are designed to take a wide range of voltage, thinking they're going to be used internationally. Some of them come with a car charger, and some of those car chargers are designed for 12 volt input to the device. So that means the ones that come with both an AC adapter and a 12 volt car battery adapter, you know, a cigarette lighter adapter, whatever you call it, that could be easily replaced with a 12 volt solar module. So, in order to make that conversion, you know, I've had good luck with just buying and using regular 12 volt solar modules, so small ones that put out 10 or 12 watts. That would be something about a foot square. And I've just gone to Radio Shack and purchased the plug that fits the same. In jack on the charger, and just replace the plug on the solar array, and then it's just a straight plug in. So the cost to go solar is really a 50-cent plug, and whatever you spend for the solar module, which could be anywhere from $20 up to $100, depending on how big it is. But I would recommend not using a solar module under 10 or 12 watts, because I think below that, the charger would have a hard time charging up any battery in less than a day, and you don't want to have to leave on charge for 2 or 3 days. So my advice is going to be, if you want to make this to be solar powered, I'd use something like a 12 to 20 watt solar module, and then you're going to almost duplicate what you're going to get out of it if you plugged in a wall outlet.
Okay, so realistically, if you wanted to have we'll call it an 8 battery recharging station, and when the price that you're giving us, is that does not, I would assuming that does not include the battery. This is just...
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
But keep in mind, you're going to be building a device that you can pick up with one hand and carry out to the truck or the car if you've had a storm, and plug it into the cigarette lighter of the car or truck, and you can recharge all your rechargeable batteries using your vehicle or while you're driving around, if you have a power outage. So you don't just have to have solar. You have the advantage that these things will also work in a vehicle. So that's one reason why I made this the shape I made it in, and why I made it the size I made it in. I wanted to make it easy that you could pick it up and carry it into something that is running, that if you are are experiencing a power outage lasting several days, this way you can recharge your cell phone, your flashlights, your radios, cameras, everything all at the same time.
So let me go back. So minus batteries, theoretically $160, and you could create an eight battery kit that does AC, DC, and solar.
Correct. And then you have to add to that the cost of the rechargeable batteries.
Right, and then the rechargeable batteries. Which, you know...
Now,
go ahead.
And those are coming down in price, too, because it seems like the world is starting to wake up, and there's more availability now, so there must be an increasing demand that's starting to happen. I mean, for example, I've seen these at Sam's and Price Club and places like that. today that I didn't see a year ago, and at pretty reasonable prices. I mean, they're approaching rechargeable batteries right now are approaching the price of a high quality, one time use throwaway battery. You know, the better ones that are made to last longer. So, I do think it's time for anybody that does find this Christmas means a lot of new devices running off of batteries that they soon are going to be dead. Maybe this will be a time to make the change. And of course, you don't have to make my battery charging station. But I am recommending that you buy one of these bulky battery charging units and put a box beside it or something where you can know you'll have some extra batteries of different sizes that are fully charged up.
Okay, so let me ask you. I don't want to not state the obvious, but I mean, what magazine is the article coming out in, and what issue?
I don't know yet. It will be out probably in the next 2 months. I can get back with you on that exactly when. Sometimes I don't always know. I mean, I write for Home Power Magazine, Backwoods Home Magazine, Mother Earth News. You know, those publications, and it will kind of depend on which one finds the timing right for them. But it will certainly be available in the next couple of months. You know, there's always a delay whenever you have an article, and it's always at least a month or two before it actually hits the print. And I don't have any control over that. But anyway, this type of information, now I have a lot of articles in Backwoods Home Magazine, which folks can find us there for a lot of this type of information, whether it's this article or other back issues on that I've written on battery charging. I've done a number of articles they can find online and download for free, where I discuss battery technology, battery recharging, a lot of solar battery charging, which I'm sure they'll find helpful, especially if they're wanting to make a changeover as I did. So,
right.
But we have, you know, last I looked, we're approaching something like about 3 billion throwaway batteries are tossed into landfill every year now in the United States. 3 billion, and that is regardless of your feelings of you know, save the earth. That's millions of pounds of metals that, you know, could be recycled and could be used for other purposes, and you know, that's I think I was reading it that right now 90% of the mercury that's in the landfills is coming from these throwaway little button batteries, the little like hearing aid batteries, the small round metal ones.
Mm-hmm.
Those use mercury in them, mercury oxide, and they said that about 90% of the mercury in landfills today is those people throwing away those little button batteries. And that's certainly a concern. And then they said about half of all of the cadmium and nickel, which are your more toxic metals, if they leach into the groundwater, you know, about half of those metals in landfills are coming from dry cell batteries or throwaway batteries. So it is going to become a bigger problem. And I think, as you pointed out when we started, this Christmas might be a time when people will recognize just how many batteries they're going to go through. And I know for me, it was a very large jar weighing around 30 pounds in about 2 years. So I probably am not quite normal compared to other folks. We do have multiple vehicles and, you know, a lot of different cameras and things. But that's still, you know, they say the average is 35 batteries per year per family gets tossed out. So
that's an incredible amount of batteries.
Yeah, and I'm sure if you have teenagers, that's probably double. It's probably double that number.
All right, Jeff. Well, we have to jump and get ready to do our last segment for the show before we wrap the show. Thank you very much for coming on. Please keep us informed on when the article is going to come out so our listeners can go ahead and see if they can build this. It'll take me 6 months to build it, but I'm sure Colorado will get it done.
I will, and I'm working on a book right now on EMP that I'm trying to get out by in the spring. I'm not sure if I'm going to make the deadline or not, but I had an opportunity to interview a lot of scientists and people who worked in the nuclear industries back in the, you know, World War II. Of course, they're very old now, but some of these guys were able to talk to me off the record, and a lot of information I'd like to pass on to folks. And so that's my project I've been working on right now, and I think that will be something folks will really find interesting, because there's a lot of myths out there that a lot of scare tactics and things. I'm trying to bring a little bit of reality to the table, and I think folks will find that interesting.
Well, when you're ready to do that, well, let us know, and we can do a whole episode on that. I know there's a lot of people interested in that topic.
Thanks again.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, guys, that was Jeff Yeago and talking about rechargeable batteries and solar batteries. We need to take a quick commercial break here, and when we come back, I think you have a homestead hunter that we need to knock out real quick, don't we, Colorado?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right, so let's take a quick break, and we'll be back after this commercial.
Hi, this is Jay Steven Stoller for Backwoods Home Magazine. If you like the program you're listening to right now, consider subscribing to Backwoods Home Magazine. Call 1-800-835-2418 or go to www.backwoodshome.com and click on the subscribe button. Every issue of Backwoods Home Magazine is over 100 pages, packed with solid self-reliance advice by experts who tell you how to survive in these unpredictable times. Call 1-800-835-2418.
All right, welcome back to Self-Reliance Exposed with Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci. Hey, Colorado, you ready to do this homestead hunter?
Yeah, sure, let's do it.
Okay, so what do you got for us today?
All right, I think I sent you the link. Did you get it?
I did. It's you actually came to my state.
Yeah, I got looking around, and I thought, why not?
All right, so let's go over this.
All right, let me pull it back up here again.
And you will have this up on your Facebook page, which is...
Yes. Is facebook.com/ Colorado Ron page. I will put it up there. But this one is in Iowa, and it's not very far from Omaha. I can't even pronounce this name of this town. Villisca?
Villisca. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Villisca, Iowa. And this is on 3.22 acres. It is a four-bedroom, two-bath home, 2,100 square foot. And it looks like a nice home. I like the big wraparound porch. You know, with 3.22 acres, you've got plenty of room to do, you know, large gardening and things like that. The home does look like it does need some repairs, but this home is listed at $80,000, and is estimated to be worth $147,000. So, I don't know. What do you think of this one?
So, I mean, we'll start from where it's located. It's a great location. It's out in the middle of farmland near a place called Red Oak, which I go through all the time when I go to Nebraska. So you're probably no more than 30, 40 minutes from Omaha. So, I mean, it's about the same drive as I have to Des Moines.
Nice.
So that's – and Omaha has a great internet – a great airport. So that's all bonus. The house is a good-sized house. It's like a good-sized Victorian. It's a 1910 Victorian farmhouse. It looks great from the outside. It looks like it's vinyl siding, So that's good. It looks like it's vinyl siding over the original wood. The inside's beautiful. I think that it looks like they kept all the original wood trim and all the character of the original farmhouse.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, I love the old staircases. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of those. It does look like some of the wall textures or wallpaper is coming down and up the staircase there. But, you know, there's a few small projects in there, but nothing major. I love the big there's that one picture there. You can see the wood trim up on the top around
the parlor.
Yeah, in the parlor. I just love that. So
yeah, well, and so this is hard. Just so you guys know, a lot of these farm homes, and this is one of them, has hardwood floors, no carpet. So they threw a lot of throw rugs on them, and these houses, the reason why they do wallpaper is plaster. All the walls are plaster with lath. So it's wood lath behind it and plaster over it. So it's a lot easier for people to steam off and put new wallpaper up a lot of the time than it is to paint them because plaster cracks.
Gotcha.
And so, you know, either that or you're always running through your house and, you know, refilling the cracks because these houses shrink and heave, you know, during the summer and the winter, and then the plaster cracks. So a lot of these houses do have a lot of wallpaper.
It's not too far from a river. I see that river down the road there on the heading east. And this, you know, I was curious about this, and you could probably answer this. The land around it, if you zoom out just a little bit, but not too much, you can still see the satellite view. You know, it looks like these, you know, they have lines through the fields like that. And I'm wondering, you know, that must be for irrigation purposes,
that,
right?
Yeah, all the land around it is terraced land.
Terraced, there you go, yeah.
Yeah, and it looks like it's all row crop. So, and I think what you're seeing is, I mean, I don't see the river. If you're talking about those trees.
No, there's a river a little bit further away down. Let's see.
Okay, I see it. Yeah. It's east.
Yep.
Okay. It looks like it's surrounded by some hardwood trees. Yeah, so again, this is a beautiful area. It's all farmland around there. So I think this is a great buy. $80,000 on 3 acres. It looks like it was probably an original farmstead.
Yep.
And they sold off the cropland first and kept the house, and now they're selling off the house, which completely makes sense because a lot of people don't want the house, but they're paying anywhere from $5,000 to $15,000 an acre for cropland.
Yeah.
And so my guess is they probably sold the cropland off first, and then went from there.
Yeah, no, I really like this home. It's got all the character that, you know, that us guys like and the women like for the, you know, with all the wood trim and the beautiful staircases. So, pretty cool home, and it looks like it's got plenty of room to do whatever you want.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody would mess with you out there. I mean, it looks like it's just kind of out there. So,
yeah, and like I said, very close to Omaha. And so, if you're wanting to get out in the country but not be too far away, this is probably good for you. This would be a good one for you, Colorado. Well, actually, not enough bedrooms. No, it's only two bedrooms.
Four bedrooms, two baths.
Yeah, that's not enough bedrooms. You're gonna have seven kids.
Oh, that's plenty of bedrooms. Stuff them in there. Back in the old days, that's why I always tell my kids, back in the old days, it was one-room cabins, and the kids lived up in the attic. All of them, all 13, 14 of them.
Well, this would be a good place because you'd be less than 45 minutes from a big church.
Oh, yeah?
Well, because I think if I remember correctly, there's the state headquarters and the historic center are right there in Omaha.
Oh, nice.
the Mormon Trail Historic Center.
Is okay. There.
Yeah, so I believe there's like there's like three churches in Omaha.
Nice.
Yeah, so I mean, like I said, good. That's a good area. It's nice. It's really, really, really nice. All right,
yeah,
well, that's
really
a good
nice.
Choice. All right, well, there you have it. You're going to go to check it out on Colorado Ron's Facebook page, and you can click on the link and check this place out. You know, we always like to have a few more people in Iowa. We don't have very many. So, got more cows than we have people. Check that one out. All right, well, the last thing that we're going to do today before we get closed up and ready for New Year's is we need to give a call to Texas Ready. So
yep.
Why don't we go ahead and take one last commercial break, and then when we come back, we'll be live with Texas Ready.
Okay.
All right.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Beach Metal Detector Guy.
Mr. Beach Metal Detector Guy.
Some seek their fortune on the stock market, others in real estate. But you look for loose change in the sand.
Hitting the jackpot.
Armed with a 5-foot Geiger counter and the world's largest set of earphones, you live your life with a simple code of honor. Finders keepers, losers weepers.
Finders keepers.
Sure, people mock you, but he who holds 92 cents, a gold-plated earring, and a steel-toed boot gets the last laugh.
Who's laughing now?
So crack open an ice-cold Bud Light, O Sultan of the Sand. We'd give you a medal, but you probably already found one.
Mr. Beach Medal Detector Guy.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, Fort Collins, Colorado.
All right, we're back with Self-Reliance Exposed, Real Men of Genius.
I
think we should just change our show to that.
Yeah. I agree. I totally agree.
Yeah, forget Self-Reliance Exposed. We're Real Men of Genius. And then we'll just have to find someone that can say that many words that quickly and just kind of run with that. All right, well, speaking of Real Men of Genius, we were geniuses and decided that we were going to beat the rush this time around. Actually, I can't take the credit for it. Colorado Run was a genius on this one. And we're going to be giving a call to Texas Ready. And Texas Ready is a heritage seed company based out of Texas. And they come to our events, and they do a fantastic job of setting up their booth and discussing with everybody the types of seeds they should have for their region. And I think we're going to be talking to Lucy. Is that right?
Lucille, yeah, huh?
Uh-huh.
Yep.
And is it Lucille? I always call her Lucy.
Yeah, I think it's Lucille. Uh-huh.
Well, I'm glad that we said it now because just like, you know, just would be like me just when we talked with Jerry from Jarbox and I'm talking about his daughter and not knowing it. Luckily, I didn't say anything bad. You know, I would have been up there, hey, Lucy! You know, kind of like, maybe even done my Desi or Nez impression and gotten in trouble.
Oh, no. Yeah, that would have been bad.
All right, you ready to give her a call?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's give her a call. All right, so
Texas Ready, may we help you?
Hey, this is Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci calling from Self-Reliance Exposed. How are you today?
I'm doing great. And you getting ready for the holidays?
Well, when people are listening to this, the holidays are pretty much over. But yeah, I think we're geared up.
Oh, that's wonderful. Great.
How about you guys down in Texas?
Oh, we are ready. Absolutely. A lot of fun parties. Of course, we had our end of the earth parties last week. Everybody survived. Margaritas in hand, you know. Pretty fun. Oh, yeah. Y2K to the extreme. There you go.
Yeah, there you go. Well, so, you know, Colorado Ron had said that he wanted to get you guys on because even though we're in the middle of December, actually end of December, it's only about 3 or 4 months until people are going to start getting ready and getting their ground ready for planting seeds. And we don't know anybody better than Texas Ready for getting that seed information. So.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so very much.
So, you know, when people are looking at sitting here in the middle of winter and everything else, tell us a little bit about what kind of prep work they can do for getting ready.
Oh, that is a great idea. Well, what they want to do is they want to, on paper, preferably the little squared paper that engineers all use, they want to plot out where they want to put their crops, taking in mind what they had in their garden previously. And they want to make sure they do a little crop rotation. So that's one thing. The second thing that they want to do is they want to go ahead and begin practicing with the very seeds that they're going to be using long term. Now, in my mind, I'm preparing for an economic downturn so that I'm going to have to provide for my family's food myself. No more trips to Kroger's and so forth. So I'm planning on being able to provide for my family, canning the things that they like, and planting the things that they like. So you want to begin working with the actual seeds that your family is going to be eating. Because what's going to happen is over time, that cucumber that you've been growing in your backyard is going to get more and more acclimated to your ecosphere, and it will become more productive just by the natural selection that you're going to do. So on paper, you're going to write down the different things that your family eats and plan on how much they eat. For example, my family eats a quart of peanut butter a month. Well, how many plants does it take peanut-wise to get to a quart? It takes 12 plants to make 1 quart of peanut butter. Therefore, I've got a plan on putting in about 200 peanut plants every spring.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So that sounds like a lot, but peanuts, thankfully, are very easy to grow, so that's not a big deal. The same thing could be said about carrots. How many carrots does your family go through on an annual basis? Well, that's kind of a big number. We're not really used to thinking like that. But if we back that up, in a month's time, how many servings of carrots does your family go through? And then you figure, well, some of the carrots by plan are not going to make it. Figure 10 to 15%. And then figure that some animals are going to eat some or the harvest. So you buffer it a little bit.
Right.
So if you need 150 carrots a year, then I would plant enough so that you actually are planting 200 carrots so that if something happens, you're still going to get to what your family needs of 150.
Okay, so I got to stop you real quick. Is I didn't know there was math involved in gardening, so I'm out. I'm out. I'm done.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it, because now I'm worried that you're going to say there's a quiz at the end of this, and so I don't do well. I don't excel in either one of those things.
There's really not math. It's only arithmetic. So there's no algebra. A little bit of geometry, but no algebra.
Yeah, so it's really not bad. It's just basically, figuring out what your family consumes, and then, I double it. And then that way, hopefully, I don't lose, 75% of my crop. But that's how I usually do it. Does that work out pretty okay?
It does. It does.
Okay.
And most people just getting into the idea of food sustainability for themselves don't realize it takes 325 quarts of food for every adult eater. Two kids under 10, that would be one adult eater. A grandmother isn't going to eat as much as a teenage boy, but the two would equal two adult eating units put together, that kind of thing. So you figure, who am I going to be providing food for? And then 125 quarts of food can come out fresh out of your garden. But beyond that, now how are we going to get the other 200 quarts of food? See, that's the big challenge. And that means that we're going to have to dehydrate some, and we can do that with solar power. We can do it like I'm not even planning on electricity, although there are some fantastic electrical dehydrators. But I'm developing a solar, and they have plans on the internet. I'm learning how to solar dehydrate a bunch of food. Okay, that takes care of some of it, but I better beef up my canning set of skills so that I know how much applesauce to put away for my family. And of course, the pioneer women all knew how to do this in their mind, and you know they knew how many bushels of whatever it took. And so that's one of the things that we at Texas Ready are you know, we're getting how many seeds produce how many pounds of food, and how much does a family of four or whatever need to eat. So that's why it's real important not to just take your seed bank and stick it on the pantry shelf saying, oh, if I really need it. No, you need to start practicing now, because gardening is not an intuitive set of skills. It's really quite interesting. Every year you're going to learn more and more, but it's really the ratios and the production that's the critical thing. Because you can be the best grower in the world, but if you're not growing enough, you know, then you're going to have trouble. So the 200 jars, a quart jars of food per person, I don't know a single family in America, even preppers, that have enough canning jars with lids ready to go for that project.
Yikes.
Yeah, really. It gives us kind of a challenge and a benchmark. A, I should really be picking up an extra dozen canning jars every time I'm at the grocery store, and, you know, so forth. So what I've been learning to do is to take the produce that I put out of my garden and extend the harvest. And that's another thing you can make through fermentation. You can go ahead and take your cabbages that you're growing, and your cabbages do not need to be refrigerated. If you do it in a sauerkraut kind of methodology with a little bit of vinegar and so forth, you can extend the life of that cabbage without refrigeration for about 6-8 more weeks. Pretty amazing. These are all skill sets that the Amish still are using, and our forefathers certainly understood. So I would say that in addition to gardening, we need to pick up and beef up our fermentation skills, our canning skills, and so forth.
No, I agree 100%. Now, one of the questions that, one of the questions that often arises is, you know, first of all, we hear the word GMO, we hear the word Monsanto, we hear the words heirloom. Can you explain some of the differences here and help us help some of the beginners out there?
Absolutely. There are two types of seed, two major categories. One is open pollinated, and one is hybrid. Now, hybrids can occur naturally, and they have been occurring naturally, or they can be man-devised. Just the fact that it's a hybrid is not necessarily bad. However, in a survival situation, which is what most of my clients are planning on, they want better nutrition, lower food bills, and in case the economics, you know, justify, they would want to provide for all their food. They cannot be depending on going back to the feed store or Lowe's or Home Depot and purchasing seeds, because those it might be too dangerous to go, A, or there might be a postal system breakdown, whatever. They're not going to get their seeds from Burpee. So they have to be able to be self-sufficient. Hybrids will not get you there. Open pollinated are the kind of seeds that you can take this, you can eat your watermelon, spit the watermelon seeds out, dry them out on a cookie sheet, and then put them back in the ground. That means that you will always have a self-sustainable situation. Those seeds are not hybridized. In those two categories, they each have subsets. So if you think about your Venn diagram, your bullseye target, for example, open pollinated is the major category. Within it is heirloom. Heirloom are open pollinated varieties that have been around at least 25 years, in most cases 50 years, and they're very, very stable. And so that's what we are aiming to do, is produce excellent tasting, highly nutritious, nutrient-dense kind of food production. That's what's in our seed banks. Now let's look over at the hybrid side. The hybrid side, within it is a category called GMO, genetically modified organism. Could also be synonymous with GEO, genetically engineered organism. Now, what that is that is not a natural process. And that would be something you would definitely want to avoid. A, that whole genetic alteration has not been tested enough, either in the agricultural world or in the drug world, pharmaceutical world, FDA and USDA, the two organizations that control the seeds and so forth. And there are unintended or unexpected consequences when these things get off into the biosphere. We've seen that in Texas. We've seen that there's the GMOs are jumping species, getting into grasses that, for example, our cows are eating, and it can wipe out a herd almost overnight because the sinusoid production within that grass would be such that would kill the cows. And that has happened near Austin more than once. That's not good. Huh. But the genetically modified organisms, what they would do is take extra species that are non-plant and modify the DNA and RNA structure of the, let's say, corn. What they would do is take a gene from a infertile woman or a gene from a salmon or a frog. They were mixing things up, take a gene gun, insert it into a virus or a bacterium, and then take that bacterium or virus and put that into the DNA structure of the corn. That is not a natural process by any means.
No.
And when we're talking about that, that's where we can get into some very serious problems. For example, there is a naturally occurring pesticide known as Bacillus thuringiensis, BT for short, and that occurs naturally. And that does affect a lot of different kind of insects. Now, when you concentrate that, which they are doing in some species of corn, what that will do is it'll kill the cornworm, and that's all well and good. Everything's great. It destroys the gut of the cornworm, and then you have a nice ear of corn. So that's the seed comes structured with the ability to produce its own pesticide. Now, that sounds all well and good. However, what they're finding is that BT actually gets into the human or animal gut, and it doesn't leave. And there's some unintended consequences. And many people believe that intestinal cancers that are on the rise and Crohn's disease and other things are a byproduct of this BT. There's inconclusive scientific studies out there. Some say that that is never removed from our gut. Some say it doesn't affect animals. But they are really tying in infertility in three generations of animals that eat some of these GMO corns. Humans have only had 20 years of this product. And, you know, obviously our generations, it would take 60 to 100 years to really get a good analysis. But there's increasing infertility, and when the mice population, the rat population, if given a choice, will not eat the GMO corn. If forced to eat it, they're infertile in three generations. That's
really?
An issue. Mm-hmm. And the Institute for Responsible Technology has loads of scientific studies and information on this. So if anybody is concerned about what I'm saying, then they can go and get a whole slew of scientific studies on this. So in my world, in my mind, I'm not going to want my family to have GMO situations. Now, Monsanto, Conagra, Bayer, and several other major ag companies have been pushing this because they would really require you to come back year by year and buy your seeds from them. So there's an economic interest. I think I don't attribute bad motives initially to them. I think they were trying to really help people and so forth, but I think that they jumped the gun in putting these things on the market before all this testing could occur and we could really figure out, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Well, it's already out there. Wheat, soybeans, corn, rice, canola, sugar beets, et cetera, between 80 and 90% of what's sold in America today in those categories is genetically altered, GMO. And every corn chip that you and I would have at a restaurant would have that GMO corn. So it's really tough if you use any kind of processed foods at all to avoid GMO. So that's why I'm thinking better nutrition, better health. I'm going to do it myself in my own backyard. I've put my ladder of trust against corporations that have proven to be singularly unreliable and trustworthy regarding the food health of my family. I'm going to remove that. I'm going to be a good steward. I'm going to take the reins of food production back, and that means I'm going to have to grow a whole lot more in my own backyard. And so that's one of the reasons that we're in business, that seed companies, seed banks are in business, is to help Americans get off of this idea of GMO. Now, it gets a little more tricky. Why don't you want to use hybrids? If I understand I'm going to avoid GMO, but why would I want to avoid hybrids? Well, a huge percentage of hybrids are sterile like a mule, so they're not good to take seed from. It's too risky. A certain percentage is going to revert to a grandparent or a parent plant because a hybrid is an F1 cross. And you don't really know which parent.
An F1 crop? What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, that'd be like if you had a lab and I had a poodle. They got together. They produced Labradoodle. Okay,
gotcha.
The Labradoodle would be the F1 cross. Now,
okay.
They might be really a cute series of dogs, but the next generation of dogs are pure mutts. They sure are not going in any, dog show and winning any awards.
Gotcha.
And they're not true labs. They're not true poodles, and they're kind of a mutant. And so in the plant kingdom, the F2 cross would be that second year. It's an unstable situation. So you've got a huge amount of sterility, you've got a huge amount of mutations, and when something is hybridized, usually it's hybridized with the idea that I want to have a sturdy exterior skin to my plant, or my tomato, let's say, and I want to make it from point A to point B so it gets to Kroger without bruising. Well, that doesn't really focus on the characteristic of taste or nutrition. And those are the two things that I'm breeding, trying to get my production to be tastier and more nutritious. And you can't do that with hybrids. So we don't want to be using hybrids or even practicing with hybrids if you are of the mindset, like most of us are on this radio program, that survival is an issue. Now, it is true, the F1 cross has a huge vigor. It's called the F1 vigor. And if you practice with your hybrids, you may think that you're a great gardener and you're growing 5-inch peppers, et cetera, et cetera. But if you then reverted back to using stuff out of a seed bank that's open pollinated or heirloom seeds, the heirlooms are not going to be as highly productive. They're about 50%. Your produce would be smaller and less of it. And so if you've been practicing at the hybrid level, you really are not going to have a good idea of what it's going to take to grow food for your family of four in a survival mode. So, again, I want you practicing with the original stuff, the heirloom stuff, so that you have a real good and accurate sense of what it's going to be like to produce food for your family.
Gotcha. Wow. Okay. All right. So now how does one know? I mean, I see a lot of people saying that they have heirloom seeds, and I just did a quick search online, and there's dozens of sites that say that they have heirloom seeds. How do you know that you're getting a quality heirloom seed? Because I've also heard that people are saying that they purchase seeds and only 50% of them sprouted, or X percentage of them sprouted. So how do you know that you're getting quality?
That's a very good question. The U.S. Department of Agriculture certifies most everything that you would find in a seed kit. There's a minimum certification as to how much germination should occur. 85% is really the threshold on average. You would want to know, are the owners of that seed company eating out of their own seed bank? Are they producing and testing the germination of the growers that they get? All the growers that I use do produce the certifications from an independent lab, letting me know how much germination occurs. And these certifications need to be current. And by current, I mean every 6 months that seed needs to be tested. It's about a $600 or $800 process to pay that fee to get that seed tested. So it's not an insignificant investment on the part of that grower. So At Texas Ready, for example, we look at those certificates, we maintain a log of those certificates, and then we do a grow out of our, you know, ourself to just see if it's true to that certificate. And then what you also want to do is get fresh seed, because there is a declining rate of germination. There's a declining ability for viability based on time. So the fresher the seed, obviously the better the situation for the homeowner. And so you don't want to be purchasing seed that's over a year old.
Okay. All right.
And for I do know of several seed banks that have 2 or 3 year old seed, and that can be a problematic when that seed's life, as certified by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, is only in the 4 to 6 year range when it's stored properly. So you don't want to be buying old seed.
Well, yeah, because I. Yeah. Well, and that's where you start hearing about these complaints of sprouting only a certain percentage of them, I guess.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, there's a lot of factors that go into that sprouting. The soil temperature is really critical, and different vegetables have a different range of temperatures that are optimum for its germination. So, for example, a bean that's got a dark shell or a molten shell, that you can put in the ground maybe a week to 2 weeks earlier because it's dark versus a white bean. So soil temperature makes a big deal, but being that it's a dark bean, it actually holds the heat of that soil that occurs during the day better than a white bean seed. I mean, it can get pretty complicated.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Well, you know, so I guess my next question is, because it's I'm sure for the person that's listening for the first time, it's overwhelming. So, first of all, how can they find out more information about you and your company? How can they find out more information about the seeds? And let's take it to there, I guess.
Okay. www.texasready is our website.
Okay. Now, obviously, your seeds aren't only good for Texas, right?
Texas Ready is an attitude or a philosophy. It's that independent spirit that helped the pioneers throughout our entire country. So it's really kind of a no-nonsense, I like independence, and I'm a freedom-loving, liberty-loving individual. So that's the sense. We sell seed all over the country and actually now the world. We prepare regional kits so that the consumer can be assured that the seeds that they get actually are going to be optimum for their area. So what I do in Texas is not going to be what I do in an altitude situation in Colorado or Oregon or Poland, for example.
Gotcha. Okay.
Now, the other thing, on the website, you know, I believe that getting the seeds, heirloom seeds, is step one. Getting the right seeds for your region is step two. And then training and knowledge and having that knowledge base in hand, in case the internet goes away, you're going to want a hard copy. We've read over 200 modern agriculture and gardening books to get us down to 6 that we think are essential for the consumer. And this will take you right from being a complete novice, never having grown anything, and even somebody that would call themselves a black thumb, all the way to someone that's been gardening 20 years.
We can take them from Bubba all the way.
That's right.
The way.
That's right.
Well, see,
that's right.
I actually had to buy the treasury, you know, uh-huh, to make sure I had enough seeds for all the mistakes I figured I'd have to make.
Well, the good thing is when that watermelon comes in for you, for example, I'll tell you a real interesting story about the abundance that you'll find out of these kits. In the two-person kit, we give you 24 watermelon seeds. That doesn't sound like a lot. In fact, the packaging, it looks like there's a lot more airspace than seeds, and you're thinking, what can this be for me? Well, those 24 seeds should produce 23 vines. Each vine should produce 2 to 4 watermelons, each 20 to 30 pounds. So these 24 seeds ended up producing 600 pounds of watermelon, which is more than 2 people would definitely eat. And then those 30 watermelons would produce probably 24,000 seeds. Obviously, you're not going to need that many for the following year. So there's an incredible yield. Once you get this thing going, it will be exponential.
Nice. Okay. Well, that's great. That's what we like to hear. So I assume you guys are coming to the Arlington Self-Reliance Expo?
The Arlington was a good event for us, and the audience is great, and the speakers are wonderful, and we really want to come to that.
Okay, great. All right. Well, we're going to set you up and see if we can't get you speaking at that expo as well. So that so anybody listening, if you guys are coming to the Arlington event in April, we will have Texas Ready there, and we'll make sure that we can get them. We're going to convince them to get on the stage. Is that all right? Is that all right with you guys?
That sounds like a plan. I'm looking forward to all America growing the food that they need out of their own backyard. Entirely possible.
Awesome. Well, great. Well, hey, I really appreciate you coming on and speaking with us, and we'll look forward to seeing you in April.
Hey, that sounds great, guys. Happy New Year.
You too.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, guys. You know, I always like talking to Lucinda.
Man, she has so much information.
I know.
I'm in information overload right now. I've been jotting down so many notes. It's like, oh my gosh.
And that's really nothing.
I know.
That's the sad part is we could probably do a 12-hour show and still not get all the information that you need.
I know. I had to end it because my brain was burning up. I was on fire.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the idea is just to get everybody thinking about it. There's never a bad time to start the stuff. And I had some questions I wanted to jump into. But, you know, I don't think people this time of year are in the mindset to start to really jump into it. But you really need to not only, think about the things you need to buy and everything else, but, you know, start getting in that mindset. She's right. Yeah, sitting down with a pencil and paper and starting to plot it out is probably a very smart thing to do now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there'll be things that you have to buy, and you know, you don't realize how much work it can be to get, if you've never done it before, to get your property set up. Now, once you've got it going, it's not that bad. But for people that are just getting into it, there's definitely some plotting and planning to do.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's plenty to do. And then the other thing you got to remember is, you know, you can start early with greenhouses and you know, things like this. So, it's not too early to start thinking about this stuff for sure.
All right. Well, let's get this thing wrapped up. I know you, like I said, everybody that's listening is listening to this on Saturday.
Yep.
You know, but right now it's Christmas Eve, and we want to get out there and spend some time with our families.
Yep.
You know, New Year's is right around the corner. 3 days later after you hear this, everybody will be getting ready for New Year's Eve. So I want to say 2012 was eventful, but uneventful. You know, the world didn't end. You know, so you still have a lot of planning to do, folks, and a lot of education that you can pick up. We thank you for all your support in 2012 at our expos and with the radio shows and everything we do. So thank you very much. And I guess we'll talk to you next year.
Sounds good.
All right, guys. Take care. As always, you can check us out at www.backwoodshome.com. Check out the information on our expos at www.selfalliancexpo.com. Our Facebook page, Colorado Ron.
Facebook.com/ColoradoRonPage.
And then Facebook for Backwoods Home is Backwoods Home Mag. Or you can check out the Self-Reliance Expo at Facebook/Self-Reliance Expo. And as always, you can do Bubba Da Vinci and check out my Facebook page. Guys, have a great holiday, and we will talk to you in 2013. See you
Take
later,
care.
Colorado. We'll be right back.
We're from North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.